I'm Haley.
I'm John.
And I'm Will.
And we're from Crimson Comet, a podcast member of the Gunna Geek Network.
Just like the one you're listening to now, the opinions expressed are those of the individual host.
Check out other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready, because geekiness begins in
3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussion ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Witten. Did you just say womp womp? And my co-host, Haley Malley.
I am a ray of sunshine.
And Keir Hansen.
Flashy lights, Christmas, woo!
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But don't worry, if we get into anything too serious, we'll warn you again.
Where we take a moment to acknowledge the fact that without the story, without the tale that demands to be told, all the flash and wonder, all the charm and beauty are nothing more than a sequence of moving pictures. The story is the pulse that gives life to a sequence of static moments, the life to a lifeless form. I'm sorry, did we get a little too cerebral there for a second? I'm sorry. Here in the GPR studios today, running as a duo, not a trio, my name is Keir, and joining me is Haley. Haley, how are you this evening?
Pretty good. Okay. Pretty good. Pretty looking good. Forward to this evening's festivities.
There are festivities. Jay is off on location doing his own thing. That's a nice way of saying he's taking a break. and we're gonna run things without him and see how it turns out.
I think run is probably not the proper term for what we're about to do to this.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
But this week, we have the honor of chatting with writer Paul Cornell, best known within the Doctor Who realm for his writing of the episodes Human Nature and Family of Blood, but appropriately this weekend, Father's Day. He also is one of the novelists responsible for keeping the Doctor Who franchise alive and vibrant during the 1990s via Virgin Publishers, along with some guys named Russell T. Davies and Stephen Moffat.
Who?
I have no idea. Nah, one of these guys. He's also a prolific comic writer for titles from Wolverine to Captain Britain, as well as TV scripts for Robin Hood and Primeval. We're pretty sure he has a personal life in there somewhere.
Yeah, some sort of strange infatuation with cricket, among other things. Yeah.
Probably schedules conversations from time to time.
when he's not scrambling for sleep here and there. So yeah, I had an opportunity to be able to chat with Mr. Cornell over this past week. He was gracious enough to give us a little over half an hour of his time to discuss everything from comics to novels to scripts to everything in between. So very good stuff in general. Before we get to that, I suppose we should probably rock our way through the news for the evening, shall we?
Let's do that.
Okay. All right. Well, the first item here is absolutely not an item whatsoever, but because of this is one of those strange weeks where you look for headline items to be released and they don't happen, the BBC hands over something to say, here you go, puppies, here's a bone. And they throw us the most neutral teaser trailer I think I've ever seen, even from
before them. We talk about what's in it, how many times did you watch it, though?
Twice, because I thought I missed something.
I know. I watched it 2 or 3 times. I'm like, wait, what?
So
for the spoiler averse, there is going to be a TARDIS and the show is coming back in the fall.
Oh, my God.
I blew it.
Yep. Nice job. So for those of you, especially here in the States, who are watching BBC America, you got to see this exclusive teaser that aired during the finale for season 3 of Orphan Black, which, by the way, I'm totally invested in, but that's a side point. They called it as such. They called this a lil, not a little, a Lil, L-I-L, Lil Doctor Who teaser. And you can just watch it for yourself, because it does nothing other than give you the vorp and show you a zoom in on the TARDIS door. And that's it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Spins around a little bit. Mm-hmm. Good times.
But thankfully, along with this, if you want to call up the news link that we'll share in the notes here, it also does give you a nice sort of piggybacking on what we did last week, a nice little synopsis of some of the things that we know so far about what's coming up in Series 9. So, spoiler alert for anyone who wants to be absolutely surprised with what's going to be happening, if you've been able to live under a substantial rock over the last 4 months or so. Everything from writers to alien incarnations to, plot devices that will or will not be used. So, you know, it's a good little compendium to keep on hand. So, it's up to you. What else we got?
Ooh, what do we want to do first? So much news this week.
Well, this is probably related to, you know, our discussion with Mr. Cornell.
Right, which you'll hear soon. Mm-hmm. But Titan is going to keep up the Doctor Who comics. Right. For another year, at least.
Yep. Have given the commissioning rights for a second year to carry the Doctor Who franchise and titles and storylines within. We had just been getting some adventures from both the 10th and 11th Doctors, as well as a brief 12th Doctor series, some War Doctor releases, some work that Mr. Cornell was doing on the Four Doctors series, which will be publishing or will be releasing in early August. We'll discuss that shortly. But they have been commissioned to take on a second year, which will give us more from the Tennant and Smith Doctors, that will be chronologically taking place right after the adventures that they have just recently published. So for those of you who are sort of toying around with the chronology and the continuity of the comic franchise, this is some good news, because Titan has been putting a lot of energy and a lot of effort and a lot of support behind continuing these expansions to the universe. As far as writers, that's all well TBD, because we know we'll probably hear back from Cy Spurrier and Rob Williams, and some artwork by Simon Fraser and Warren Pleece. But other than that, a lot of it's going to be up in the air. They're just at the stages where the ink is just drying on this agreement. So, lastly, kind of an Access Hollywood meets Gallifrey kind of thing, I guess, if you want to call it that. And that's just big fat Jenna Coleman news that she's going to be the next Princess of England. It's going to happen. Queen. Yeah, it can't happen. I mean, once you're dating Prince Harry at this point, where do you back off? I mean, where at the bar has been set.
I mean, she went from King in the North to Prince of Wales. Like, I think that's a step down.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, she has to, you know, take on like the president of the universe or something, and it's not going to work. So yeah, there have been a lot of not only sightings. At this point, it's pretty much just almost open admissions that they are very close together as they make all of these public appearances. They're not even. This isn't just a matter of passing people of note. This is now they are arriving and departing together and things of that sort. So, get yourself all a flutter over that. It's a big old deal.
Well, the article did make a point of saying that it's probably not serious right now because their schedules won't allow anything serious.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, because that's schedules really keep people apart a lot. But yes, definitely for those of you who really enjoy getting into the personal lives of the people that we hold near and dear, this is good fodder. Or for any of you who are just really into the royals. So there you go. Art imitates life, imitates art. So as far as our topic of the evening, we did, as I mentioned, have an opportunity to speak with Mr. Paul Cornell about his work on his upcoming comic series, one related to the Doctor Who universe, one unrelated, but still in the paranormal / supernatural milieu, for those of you who enjoy that sort of thing, and reasons why you should head down to your local comic shop and start clamoring for some advance orders, as well as just his experiences writing for Doctor Who on screen and in novel form. So let's take a second to cue up the interview here and have a listen. This evening we are joined in the GPR studios by famed Doctor Who novelist, screenwriter, comic book writer, and cricket aficionado, Paul Cornell. Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, sir.
Oh, hi. Hey, how are you?
Fantastic. It is wonderful having you with us today. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, we have noted throughout that you've been rather well-traveled this year to date.
Oh, my goodness. I'm trying hard not to, you know, go away too much because I'm helping bring up my little son. But I'm still doing quite a lot. it's a busy year for me.
Absolutely. Well, with all the balance of everything on the road, doing a lot of you've just come back from another trip here to the States within the last month or so. And between that and the balance of all of the domestic responsibilities and things, what has been keeping you busiest as of late?
Well, all the writing. I mean, it's... this is perhaps my single busiest year in terms of variety of stuff, and that's exciting. You know, that's what you want. So I can't really complain. But having to swiftly move between so many different projects, and actually the hardest thing is to promote more than one thing at once. I've got four Doctors, this damn band, and my short story collection, and Witches of Lichfield at the end of the year. And I'm having the need to publicize them all virtually simultaneously. And that means that every time I sort of lean heavily on one, another one, you know, kind of maybe suffers a bit. And wow, I could do with things not coming along at once.
Or just recruiting us to be better advocates on your behalf so you can take a nap every once in a while, I suppose.
Well, that was sort of my thing of saying to all podcasters, come and interview me. It's kind of, this has filled up my evenings neatly. I had an hour or two here or there that I wasn't doing anything with, and now that's been absolutely filled. So awesome.
Well, we'll certainly take a second or two at the end of the conversation here to get an idea from about some of the many releases that are still yet on the horizon. But for the moment, we do have some questions that I and my co-hosts, as well as a few of our listeners, wanted to pose to you, if you have a moment to clear.
Sure.
All right. Well, first off, I mean, probably what you just alluded to here as far as just what has been keeping you scattered to the four winds. I mean, as an accomplished author and a writer for varying media, from the screenplay work to the novelizations and original novels to your to the Shadow Police series and everything that you have, all the plates spinning at the moment. Do you find that you approach these different media differently in your writing style?
Oh yeah, you really have to switch gears in your head. If I was living a life of luxury and was a very, very rich best-selling author, I would take care to only do one type of writing every day. But this just is not happening. You really have to budget for different things in your head for each different style. Like for comics, it's about budgeting space on the page, number of panels, number of words in a panel, how simply can you describe the action to fit it into a small space. You've in theory got an infinite budget, but actually you haven't, because the artist is just not willing to draw those 10,000 warriors coming over the hill. But you've got a much bigger conceptually budget than any form of movie or TV. Whereas with TV, it's about budgeting actual money as well as all the other constraints of time. The two forms do have some things in common, which are about, you know, telling things with great brevity and simplicity. And they do, I think, as I become a better comic writer, I become a better TV writer and vice versa. But when you move into novels, then suddenly your palette is just much bigger. It's like an enormous palette you're carrying around. You're an artist and you've got an enormous palette. That's not very good, is it? I'm only around you until about 6 p.m. in the evening and you're catching me about 9. But anyway, with your enormous palette, you need a pretty long brush to reach some of those colors over there. Anyway, the enormous palette of a novelist is that, you know, you can go into people's heads, you can switch points of view, you can describe, you're the director, the cinematographer, and the set artist. So, you know, you kind of, you're in charge of everything suddenly. An editor of mine recently said that I did the least description of any writer he'd ever met. He regarded this as a big positive. But I kind of do for books set in modern day London. I feel that people basically, I just tell them where we are, and they kind of know what that looks like, and I'll just add a little bit of detail. I mean, a little bit of what the atmosphere is like. But I kind of thought, oh, that's not quite what I want, because when I'm in books, obviously I've had my head trained from comics and TV to describe very little. But when I'm in books, I would quite like to be a more descriptive prose writer. So maybe I'll have to step back from that a bit. But actually, you know, normally the flaw is too much description.
Mm.
So, you know, anyway, I've gone on and on.
That's quite all right. Because you've given us an excellent segue here into some of the comic work that you have just on the horizon, something that you're holding very near and dear, which will be the upcoming release of This Damn Band.
Oh, yeah.
Now, this is an interesting project for you, something that I would have said maybe 6 or 8 months prior, I would not have expected this sort of a milieu to evolve from your work. Now, because it is steeped in the classic rock 70s era, that sort of a backdrop, were there specific stories or instances from music history, like the Aleister Crowley fascination that Jimmy Page carried around with his middle years with Led Zeppelin, or Black Sabbath stage personas being very enamored with the dark tendencies and things? Were these any of the sparks to your idea of the "we sold our souls for rock and roll"?
Oh yeah, I mean, this is a book about a very rich, globally famous, successful rock band in the 1970s. Who like to say that they worship the devil, only to find to their horror that they're actually worshipping the devil. It's a comedy, it's satire, it's a very dark comedy, it's a horror comedy. It's told to camera, it's a documentary put together from footage. So we have two-camera interviews and, you know, different filming styles and all that. So but Tony Parker, the poor artist, has to do all sorts of things, like in some cases when it's the band recounting something that's happened to them and the film crew have only heard about it, they can't, you know, have no footage, it's replaced by art done by local artists, so suddenly he has to go into a completely different art style. When we're in Japan, it's a kind of manga car art, and when we're in France in issues 3 or 4, it's tinted. And he's done a fabulous job with that. But specific satire. We've boiled together lots of different real life situations and figures to be able to talk about all sorts of things, like the Jimmy Page stuff. The band's manager is very like Peter Grant of Led Zeppelin, but who's famously bombastic and in your face, but he's also got a lot of Crowley mixed in with him. And there's basically satirical takes left, right, and center on that incredible moment in about 73, 74, where it was actually incredibly fashionable. The occult was incredibly fashionable, and especially for rock bands. And in a pop way that defies belief now. Can you imagine Marvel publishing a Son of Satan comic now?
Maybe not Marvel. Maybe one of our smaller independents might make a chance on something of that sort. Yeah.
But I find this fascinating because for most of these bands, and probably not Page. Page was quite serious and still is. But for a lot of these bands, this was just a pose. Black Sabbath really were a bunch of brickies from Birmingham who wouldn't know their Crowley from Dennis Wheatley. And, you know, they didn't make any secret of that, really. But it was a nice pose. And I'm fascinated by the way, you know, a bunch of folk who were very domestic, who've been launched into luxury by sudden riches and have certain poses going on. If they're then confronted by the reality of that pose, it sort of crashes sidelong into them. And I found that really interesting and the subject for a lot of dark comedy. Various members of the band are more serious about their love for Satan than others. And one of them, No, I'm not going to give away any jokes. No.
Very well.
but it's the art is delightful, and it becomes slightly more serious as we go on. It's I like that Parks and Recreation thing of talking directly to camera. And I love the fact that how easily it gives you the impression of the gap between what people are saying and what they really mean. And but this is kind of Parks and Recreation with horrifying consequences creeping in as we go along. It's what my wife calls "ha ha bang." She thinks this is one of my typical forbs that that I will lead people to a comedy and then something awful happens towards the end of it.
Well, that's the ultimate punchline, then, isn't it? Huh?
this damn band is. We're trying to get people to pre-order now because pre-orders matter incredibly in the world of comics. In your comic shop, please ask for the first issue. Because people always say to me on Twitter, "Oh, I went into my comic shop. Well done, they'd sold out of your comic. They'd sold out of my comic." Sometimes because they'd only ordered two copies because nobody had pre-ordered. And so what we're after here is people to get in early with us and.
Is there a particular means to ensure when going into one's local comic shop that the pre-order will be successful? Are there any codes or indications that they have to provide?
Yes, there are. Really, you should be able to just walk into your comic shop, go up to the counter and say, "I'd like to order this damn band, issue one." And they should be fine with that. But if they want some more information or are having trouble finding it in their catalogue, which they really shouldn't, you can quote the Diamond order code to them, which is JUN150081. But honestly, you don't need that. It makes it sound, I think, perhaps a little harder than it is. You're just walking into a shop asking to pre-order a comic.
Certainly.
So we do appreciate that, and thank you very much for giving me the chance to say that.
Absolutely. And the anticipated publishing date is...
Said he, quickly looking at his diary, it is August the 5th, Wednesday, August the 5th, which is, exactly a week before Four Doctors issue one. So that's going to be quite a week for me.
Quite a bit. Well, there's an excellent segue if ever I heard one here.
Well, yeah.
We're all very eager here, at least in GPR Studios, to get our hands on this series.
You have not seen the artwork. My goodness, Neil Edwards. I mean, people have seen those first six pages with the War Doctor stuff, but it's in a slightly different style to the rest of it. He gets way more photorealistic with the stuff set in, if you like, the present day. And that big splash page of the Doctor and Clara, the current Doctor, is very much more the style for the rest of the series. And I'm getting these amazing pages of lots of Doctor interaction with lots of body language. The wonderful thing about Neil is I can say to him, Matt Jones is making a point. Did I just call him Matt Jones? Yeah, okay. Because featured in this is the New Adventures author, Matt Jones. I haven't revealed that anywhere. Matt Smith is making a point. And he'll have that slightly lent over, two fingers, one finger on each hand up gesture that Matt does when he's making a point. And so you can feel the presence of these actors through their body language as well as their likenesses, which is a lovely thing. I've got a chase sequence that he's got Matt with his knees up running along like Troughton. And it's just beautiful. And there's tons of Doctor interaction. My feeling when I was given this assignment was, what does the audience want more than anything else out of a Morty Doctor story? I think they want the Doctors to be together and showing off character against each other, knocking sparks off each other as much as possible. And so it's continual doctor-on-doctor action. Although Clara very much wants to avoid what she calls some kind of multi-doctor event, mm-hmm. and actually says, "Step away from the multi-doctor event" at one point, because there will be terrible consequences, she thinks, if this occurs. She fails in this mission and a Morty Doctor event actually starts to happen. And what's really interesting is it lets you dissect the personalities and the voices of these three doctors and have them by having them interact and seeing how they get on. And I just sort of instinctively felt that the 10th doctor would have a real problem with the 12th, and to some extent vice versa. And we've got the 11th in the middle, who's trying to sort of be a much more thoughtful referee between them. And because, of course, the 12th cannot and will not tell the other two how he even comes to be. And this is also all set, because the Titan comics wonderfully are set at very specific points in the television continuity. This is all set before the 10th and the 11th have met as well. So it's our job to come up with good reasons why all this can happen, and we will. That's actually at the heart of the whole story. So, you know, 10 doesn't even know 11 is also the Doctor until he checks him out. And 12 really doesn't feel like explaining to the other two how he can even exist.
Colour us surprised.
Yep. And also, he regards the other two as being sort of slightly inferior, you know, prototypes. Mm-hmm. The Madic Pixie Dreamboat Doctors, as he calls them. But 10 really, 10 still full of guilt, still full of that unexpressed tension about the Time War, thinks something really bad must have happened to create 12. Just cannot see how he can still be around. And it's just a recipe for fun antagonism and lots and lots of one-liners between the three of them. And there's also old monsters and just roller coaster blockbuster plot, really. You know, this isn't one of my tear-jerky ones. This is a rush-along one for 5 issues across 5 weeks. And I'm loving it.
Great. Well, we're absolutely looking forward to it. Now, we didn't have to note that when more and more details were emerging about the construct of this particular series, or what was admitted to be included, and the identity of the Fourth Doctor that was going to be involved, there was a bit of a, we'll call it a hubbub, we'll call it a kerfuffle, we'll call it other kind words to say that there was some discussion about the inclusion of the War Doctor as your fourth, as opposed
people think they now know what Four Doctors means as a title, and they do not.
Okay.
Fans always want what they don't have. The original assignment was, let's bring these three ongoing titles together for 5 weeks. And also, Christopher Eccleston's miniseries was launching around the same time. And so I think they didn't want to take the spotlight off of that. And, you know, fans saying Titan don't care about the ninth Doctor, it's rubbish. Spoilers, but have you seen the last page of the last issue of the current 10th Doctor run?
We have seen some panels, yes.
Well, you know, obviously there's some ninth Doctor love going on there.
Quite a bit, yeah.
I'm just going to say, trust me. And also, trust me that I loved Christopher Eccleston's portrayal, and there's nothing negative about where we are with this series about him, or about that Doctor, or anything like that. And there are lots of reasons why this is called Four Doctors.
All right, so the entendre is to be determined upon reading.
Mm.
All right. Well, in regards to writing for the Whovian universe, or the Hooniverse, as some people want to refer to it, there have been a number of interesting anecdotes that you have shared with interviewees in the past. From Russell T. Davies, Stephen Moffat has shared some of these, and others who wrote for Doctor Who during the Virgin novel days. Or as you've referred to them on more than one occasion, the theme park years.
Yeah, because it's not a bloody wilderness at all.
Well, has the return of the program since 2005 and the now global resurgence of the program itself, potentially you could argue far more than it had achieved within its initial inception. Has that had a positive or negative impact on that sort of unchecked or unbridled creativity that you were able to express in the early 90s?
Well, I'm not sure it's a positive or a negative effect. It's like just a different playing field. I mean, certainly we've got a whole new gang of book and, to a much lesser extent, audio writers and new comic work writers as well, writing the spin-offery now the show is back. And we've got some fabulous new writers like Una McCormack and Jenny Corgan. And what the spin-offery has to do is it's a different function when the show is on the air to when it's off. You know, it's carrying a different weight. It's just a different world. So I think there can still be unbridled creativity, but it's just expressed in different ways. I mean, the Titan Comics is a really good sign of it. They do not feel like they are at all hampered by working around and living with and stitching together between the gaps of the TV show. They feel actually energized by that. And I think it's just a different way of playing. You have to play a different way on a different pitch, possibly carrying an enormous palette.
For those of you keeping track at home, we were able to involve both Cricket and another artist reference within the mixed metaphors as far as the eye can see.
Oh, yes, goodness.
But so you feel that that to a certain degree, what you may trade in concerns over potential continuity are supported on the other side by the fact that you have had all of these new expansions or new avenues that can be explored?
Well, yes, and you know, obviously the ideal shape for Doctor Who is to be on television. However, if it's not on television, then there's all these fantastic different opportunities for what it can be. And I think in the years between the old show and the new, Doctor Who was reinvented in that dry dock, in that lab. I think it was kind of all the concepts were proved away from the light of being a mass show again. It was a cult show while it was off television, and then it went back to being not a cult show, but a show for everybody when it came back. And that move is actually that movement is quite tough to navigate, but at the same time, it's a wonderful stirring of the pot. I think. You know, if you can go from that and from mass to cult and back to mass again, the things you stir up culturally, the number of good creators you get on board, it didn't just prove Doctor Who could keep going those 15 years. It gave it new life. And, you know, I think you simply cannot stitch Rose and Survival together. The DNA of Doctor Who was changed in those 15 years by the people who worked on it outside of television, including many, many of the creators when it came back. And, you know, 10 years later, it's built and built upon itself, and it's grown in wonderful ways. If it goes away again, I think the same thing will happen. I think a new revolution will come along, and it'll be exactly the same as last time. It'll be an initial phase where things try and stay similar to the TV show, and then, you know, inspired by what happened last time, a bunch of folk will come along, and there'll be another revolution, and off it'll go as another fireworks display, as another wonderful fractal burst of creativity, which will probably piss me off. because I'm now of the generation that should be annoyed by that. Hmm. You know, unless I can, you know, manage that wonderful Terrence Dix thing of being the golden thread that, you know, stretches between all of this. But Terrence will still be probably around to keep doing that, you know.
He absolutely will. He's absolutely timeless. We had a chance to chat with him back in November in New York, and he was prepared to drop back into it at a moment's notice, as he was just as he was willing to say, it's all about the paycheck. It's really all about the paycheck at the end of the day. So.
Oh yeah. Well yeah. Like that's true.
I think that's his rote response. You could tell there was a twinkle behind all that through the entire.
It's a humble response, I think.
Quite. Now, to give you a bit of a break, somehow in the midst of all of this, that you have had going on, you have been able to produce a series of novels, and hopefully right now just in the pair, and hopefully going to extend much farther in the James Quill novels. Now, based on my personal experience, I think as far as most of the material that I've been able to read from you, whether they were, you know, the version Doctor Who novels or any of the comic work and things, this is probably some of the grittiest writing I've personally been able to enjoy of yours.
Well, this is the messiest. It's I wanted to do something. The Shadow Police novels are police procedural occult urban fantasy. And the police procedural bit really is important to me. I want to get all the details right. And I've got some retired and current officers and intelligence analysts from the Met who are actually mostly Doctor Who fans, who are on side to give me that info. And Andrew Smith actually has been incredibly helpful, who's just retired from his career in the Met. And because he's also a writer, of course, he can give me stuff in a shape which will allow me to use it dramatically. But they're about a small group of undercover police in the modern era who suddenly gain the ability to see the dark monsters and the magic in London. And most of the London lore I use is real, in inverted commas. It's stuff that legends that are genuinely told about London. And I'm working on the third one now. I'm just going through the second draft, responding to editorial notes. It's going to be out about this time next year, because that's how publishing works. Basically, I finish it and they publish it months and months and months later, a lot of which is about not the physical time it takes to produce a book, but when the best moment to set it loose is. And because actually, one of the things is they only have so many... they want to get the publicity push behind it that month, and there are lots and lots of other books, and they have to line them up and separate them, as it were, so that they don't come out in clusters.
Understood. Okay.
But I like how dark they are. There's lots of humor, but it really lets me let out the dark stuff and hopefully find hope at the end of it. It's kind of the opposite of ha ha bang. It's more bang ha ha. And by the end of the third book, because they went to very dark places in the second one, yeah, and we're dealing with the consequences all the way through book three. And it all ends up in a very different place by the end of book three. I'm aiming for 5 books all in all.
Okay, wow.
Because I think it's good to have an ending. And I kind of know what book 5 is. Book 4 will be whatever whodunit or crime story shape occurs to me. I have a vague idea about taxis for book 4. But book 5, I know exactly what it's going to be, and it'll finish the shape of the series and answer all the questions. Although lots of questions get answered in 3 as well.
Excellent. Okay. Yeah, because without giving too much away, for those of us who had gone through book 2, the descent to pun intended, was rather severe, and you have to wonder where you could possibly go from there without feeling like you've set the bar extraordinarily high and yet low.
Yes, I know what you mean.
Does that work?
Neil's not back in book 3. I think people have asked, is he coming back? Neil Gaiman is in book 2 as himself. And I got a huge red circle from my copy editor and the manuscript with just written in big capitals, does he know? And people still pop up on Twitter going, how dare you? Does he know about this? like I would put one of the most successful authors just randomly in my book, and they'd let me do that.
You have to trade that off for an appearance in the American Gods series when that goes to production. You get a walk-on role gratis. That would be nice.
Yeah, no, man in background with ice lolly. But he was delighted to do it. I can't pull that trick again. I think we've got to move on now. So. Three is, I think I can say three is largely about The Legends and Mystique of Sherlock Holmes. And we got into a lot of Holmesian detail.
Oh, okay.
And I won't go any further than that. But if book one was about does every player who scores a hat-trick against West Ham Football Club die in horrible circumstances, and book two was about Jack the Ripper is back and he's only killing rich white men, book three is about the shadow that Sherlock Holmes casts over modern London.
All right. Okay. Quite relevant and topical to present culture.
And it is actually a murder mystery. And my first proper whodunit, actually. Because in book one, certainly the audience is ahead of our heroes and basically knows what's going on to some degree. Mm. And two isn't a standard whodunit. Three really is a whodunit. And I'm quite pleased to have sorted something out that, you know, demands clues and red herrings and things like that.
Excellent. Well, so that means that I probably had a reverse writing style, you know, backing up from your conclusion, your reveal, and getting yourself the breadcrumbs.
People who do this for a living, my goodness. Do you know the people who really amaze me? People who do full murder mysteries for tie-in novels. They win all the Scribe Awards, these wonderful award systems for tie-in writers. Mm. And I still feel instinctively that, you know, I'm kind of on side with those guys. And to write a full murder mystery for a Murder, She Wrote novel, that takes such dedication. Because murder mysteries are hard.
It seems to be. And then covering your tracks in reverse for 15 chapters or so.
Oh, and especially having, you know, red herrings walk in. It's the only genre where somebody with a beard can walk in going, yes, I seem to be quite evil, don't I? But I'm actually just a bit arch. Goodbye.
I'm just here for some chips. Cheers.
Yes.
Well, with everything now, everything we know that we're going to be expecting releasing over the next couple of months from the comic side, you're mentioning to us that we should hopefully be able to see the novel publication around this time next year, and everything else interspersed between. Will we here on the state side, can we hope to see you at any upcoming U.S. conventions like New York Comic Con or Chicago TARDIS?
Neither of those two. But Chicago, I would like to go one day. Maybe not this year. I'm trying to limit my, as I said, my trips abroad. I'm going to Convergence in Minneapolis next week, week after next, and then I'm off to San Diego Comic Con, where I'm on huge Four Doctors panel not just a Four Doctors panel. It's about all their Doctor Who range, of course it is. The Titan. And sorry, that was so presumptuous of me. It's got all loads of the other writers and artists, and Alice Zhang, who does the covers as well, which is an amazing artist.
They have been stunning, yes.
Oh, yeah. And so I'm doing San Diego as well. And is that it for the States? Maybe, this year. I'm, of course, going back to Gallifrey in February.
Mm-hmm. We'll certainly hope to see you there. We were hoping we might be able to sway you, or at least put a bug in your ear about the Long Island WhoCon done in New York.
I've been wanting to go to that for ages.
And we had a blast with it last year, spending the weekend with Nick Briggs and Jason Hay-Gallery and all the Big Finish crew that was there.
I'd really like to. Again, a lot of it depends if they ask me. Mm. You know, it's Long Island 2 sounds great. I think it's really good that these other conventions are springing up now.
Quite so. It's served the East Coast of the U.S. quite well in terms of gathering a tremendous talent pool to be able to literally rub elbows with, because it's such an intimate and well-attended convention of sorts.
Oh, so, yeah.
I'll chat with with some of our directors and coordinators for that crew and see if we can't touch base with you.
Well, when's the next one?
That is held always in November.
Right.
I think it's slated this year for the second week of November.
Oh, I might be at Thought Bubble. the British Comic Convention. Anyway, sorry, this is fascinating for your listeners, isn't it? can we talk about some expenses? But anyway,
you certainly can. So what do you find is the best commuting route to get yourself from Ottawa? Or what are your thoughts on the unleashing? They've decided to release the Whomobile back out to after 20 years of being packed on ice.
That's quite a surprise.
Well, all in all, just to recap here, for those of you who are anxiously awaiting the Four Doctors released through Titan Comics and this damn band through Dark Horse, correct? Okay. We'll be seeing those within the first week of August, but please be sure to get to your local comic shop to request those in advance, particularly this damn band, because it may not be a title that they here in the States are yet familiar with, or that they have had limited copies prepared for shelf stock. So talk to them and talk often. Well, all right. Well, thank you once again for your time and your company, Mr. Cornell. It's been wonderful speaking with you.
Thank you very much. And, a pleasure to be on another podcast.
Cheers. And for those of you interested in keeping tabs with the flurry of news and releases and activities from Paul Cornell, do be sure to check in often at paulcornell.com, as well as living vicariously through him on Facebook and Twitter, just as we do. All right. Thank you so much for your time, Mr. Cornell.
Thank you very much, Keir.
Cheers.
Bye.
So that was our opportunity to speak, Mr. Cornell. An absolute pleasure.
You keep saying we an hour, like we were all there.
We. Well, you know, I had you guys in mind.
The royal we.
I had pictures of you up on screen. I had my little Haley bobblehead right here. I'm sorry.
It's mostly hair.
Oh, that was Tom Baker. I'm sorry. It looked a little bit like Haley for a second. I don't know. That was mean, probably. But yes, so plenty of good information about what he has coming down the pike as far as comic publications. Please. I'm absolutely jazzed about Four Doctors, and now hearing the little tidbits about not exactly spoilers, but a little bit of exclusive information that we have about some of the things that are being alluded to within the Four Doctors. I'm sorry, Four Doctors, not the Four Doctors, because the is not in the title. This is definitely something to look forward to. So please get yourself a hold of that and this damn band, because I personally, growing up on a lot of classic rock and listening to a hell of a lot of Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath and whatnot over the years, this is right up my alley. So I know I'm already in for my issue one.
I think I've got a lot of comics to read.
I think you got a substantial backlog there. I think you can take care of. Are you up to the 1970s at this point? Or
yes, I am.
You have just broke into the 70s?
I think I'm in like 71. I haven't read as much lately. I've been busy doing these stupid podcast things.
Yeah, well, the color and the ink gets much better in the 70s. They discover that there's actually a full spectrum and not just red, yellow, and green.
That's lovely.
So, a little bit of feedback as we were leading into this week's discussion with Mr. Cornell. Ben, a good friend of ours from the UK, had an opportunity to chime in both on Facebook and Twitter and just comment that Paul is an excellent writer and a truly great bloke and wanted to make sure that there was cricket talk. So, there you go. I promised you, Ben, you would get it. It's a little confusing because it is convoluted with an artist's metaphor, but if you can wade through it, you get your reward. But make sure within if you haven't read the Shadow Police series of novels, Severed Streets and London Falling, in reverse order, London Falling was the first book. You get plenty of cricket involvement there, so you can definitely tell where his passions lie. And a little earlier today, because of Father's Day we're recording here, Sunday the 21st, we took a second just to pose out there just for ha-has because of the fact that this was the 7th anniversary, or I should say, yeah, 7th anniversary of the airing of Turn Left, which was a big Wilfred Mott episode. So, obviously involving Wilf and thinking, well, Father's Day, I decided to put it out there and say, you know what, as far as endearing paternal characters, you know, who do you consider to be on the higher pedestal, Wilf or Brian, in quotation marks, Pond Williams? Of Brian's log. And before I even get to the feedback, Haley, where would you chime in on this?
See, Brian feels very fatherly. Wilf feels grandfatherly. So, okay. Oh, that's a tough one.
They're both,
I think Brian.
Yeah, they're both dropping off the cliff. You can only reach for one hand.
I think Brian.
Wilf's
just because he's
good
got
run.
More time left. Wilf had a long, full life. Wolf would want it that way.
Nice job, Greybeard. See ya. So, well, Kodiak chimed in and said that is absolutely a poll that I will not take part of because both are great characters. So nice job dodging the bullet on that one.
Let me not answer your question.
Look over there, a blip. And another Twitter follower, Epic Crescendo, wrote in, I absolutely loved Wolf. Such a great character, both from the writing and from the acting portrayal. Absolutely, couldn't agree more. Although Brian's eventual loss gave him tragic stature, and that probably referring to the unfilmed coda at the end of Power of Three that we've seen the storyboard to. And the did they do a full audio of that? How did that get presented to us in audio?
I don't remember.
Yeah, it's out there on YouTube. Make sure you grab it. In fact, I'll try to take a point of including that into the notes for those of you who have never seen it. I do suggest that you watch the episode first, and possibly even watch the Pond Life webisode miniseries first to really get yourself back fully steeped into pondisms.
Yeah.
And then watch this so that it can smash your heart into 1,000 pieces and dance upon its ashes.
Yeah.
So
for those of you that don't enjoy being happy, there's this.
Yeah. What better way to wrap up Father's Day than with a horrible, heartbreaking tale of paternal love? So. Yeah. So in conclusion here, we have had an opportunity to speak with a phenomenal writer this week, and we'll hopefully be able to see him again at conventions in the very near future. For those of you who are in Minneapolis in the following weekend and get a chance to see him at the next con coming out there, please, please, please get a quick selfie with him, you know, reference us so we can see how he's doing and make sure that he's getting adequate sleep, because, you know, we worry. So, and in conclusion, this has been episode 141 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, Jay has absolutely nothing to say, and we wish him the well. This is Kier saying, have you been to your local comic shop yet?
And this is Haley saying, none of our listeners can give a straight answer to a poll.
That's so true. Night, folks. I don't see you.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2015.
All right. Want to just rock into this thing? Show Jay that it can actually be done in record time?
Let's do this, bitch.
All right.
Wait, I thought she was dating a different prince.
No, it's always been this one. The other one's married.
No, she was dating...
Oh, the Prince
Stark.
Of...
Stark, yeah. Of Winterfell.
Yeah, no, that broke up like a year ago.
Psh, I'm not up on it.
Yeah, yeah. Big deal. It's a really big deal. Like, however big of a deal you thought it was, double that. Big. 21 minutes, done.
Boom.
Suck it, Jay.
That's how you do it. Jeez. Act like we're the ones that drive this thing off the rails.
God, what the hell are you doing all night long?
All right. Because we're professionals. Jeez.
And stuff.